session. Judge Reyes, Judge Smith, Judge Bratful, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes Jr. presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, July 6, 2023. We have three cases on our calendar set for oral argument today. The first of the three is A-230201, Colby Lake Fourth Association versus Hiscox Insurance Company, Inc. I see there are two counsel for appellant. Are both of you going to be arguing or just one? Okay, great. Thank you. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you so choose. The podium in the middle, there's a button underneath to lower or raise it. You can also adjust the microphone as well. There is a timer on the podium indicating how much time you have. Please make note of that so you know not to run over your allotted time. When you approach the podium, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. And with that, counsel, for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Adina Bergstrom, and I represent the appellant in this case, Colby Lake Fourth Association. Colby Lake is here today requesting this court reverse the grant of summary judgment that was issued sua sponte by the district court, absent any opportunity for any party to be heard on summary judgment, as well as remand for a proper finding of interest on the appraisal award that was entered in 2019. We are further seeking a declaration and reversal by this court of the denial for declaratory judgment that was issued by the district court judge pursuant to remand of this court in the matter of Colby Lake 1, which was this court file number A20-1447. Most issues in this case will be reviewed de novo. With respect to summary judgment, that is reviewed de novo.
Why is de novo applied to our review of default judgment? That's abuse of discretion for that.
It certainly can be, Your Honor. And I believe, yes, jumping to the meat of this case, which on remand, this court sent the file back down to the district court to make additional factual findings on the Findon factors, because at the time of first appeal, there weren't factual findings for this court to properly review Findon. There was a discussion on the record during oral argument about whether de novo review or remand was appropriate, because this court had the discretion to do both. On the record, it was then sent back down for that particular reason. The problem here, and it's somewhat unique, is that the order opinion issued by this court was very specific in enumerated paragraphs about what the trial court was to do. And of concern is the fact that in paragraph 13, this court directed the district court to use the February 26, 2020 record in order to reconcile the findings.
Which it did. It acknowledged that it only relied on the record prior to that date.
I believe that that's in question, Your Honor, because in document 106, I believe on page 14, the court specifically references in her decision that she's relying, when she's comparing the conduct in this case of not just the attorney, but the corporate entity as well, the court specifically references the affirmations by Jeanette Dixon, who was the lawyer, as well as Hiscox's submissions and that conduct. And the only time that we see any evidence in the actual record of Hiscox's conduct and what they did after they were served personally with this complaint on September 12th of 2019 is in the supplemental record that the court permitted in 2022.
Well, counsel, what case is there, if any? I mean, we do know they had counsel. We know that much. So it's not a case where, like one of the cases cited, where a party didn't even get a lawyer, right? They get a summons and complaint, and they don't get a lawyer. We know that Hiscox had counsel. We know they had local counsel. We know that local counsel sent it to New York counsel. That's all on the previous record. Is there any case in which an appellate court has directed entry of default judgment because a party with counsel didn't do enough. I mean, you know, in other words, the party got counsel. They had counsel. Yes, the counsel appears to have, like, missed it. That's, like, clear. So then the question is there any case where we've told a district, you abuse your discretion by not granting default judgment because a client who had counsel didn't do enough?
Yes, you know, I believe there is, Your Honor. For instance, you know, in the Howard case, there's discussion about a paucity of evidence about what the individual party did or did not do. And that
is that the outside counsel or the individual party?
So individual party, Your Honor.
Is that a pro se case or
that is not a pro se case. The pro se case would be Black versus Rimmer is the pro se case where even this court said even a pro se defendant or a party needs to follow the procedural rules. And that's part of the reason why this court initially sent it back down was because there was at least some analysis about what counsel for Hiscox had done. But there was no analysis about whether this was an innocent party. And I think that Cole versus
when you're talking about innocent party, are you talking about the client in this case, Hiscox?
I am. When I talk about innocent client or innocent party, I'm speaking to the actual party that was sued. And Cole versus Wutzke, which I know that Your Honor was a part of at the Court of Appeals, addressed this issue and looked at the history of case law. This is meant not all. Sometimes when a lawyer does make a mistake and the client is not implicated at all, like in Cole where it was a mistake of law about when the complaint should be filed, you know, the Minnesota law is clear. Well, we're not going to punish the client in that circumstance. But that's different. The history of case law in Minnesota talks about we're not going to excuse party neglect. We're not going to excuse when the party sued does not take reasonable steps to ensure that it's being protected. And that is a contrast to cases such as Black versus Rimmer on one end of the continuum, Cole versus Wutzke is on the other. Other cases like the Imperial Premium Finance case, where you have a corporate entity that's been sued, we've got a complaint that winds up on someone's desk and is lost, there's no excuse for that. Same with the Hovelson case.
That's not the case here, though.
In this case, Your Honor, in 2020, I think this is where we get back to the paucity of evidence. Hiscox doesn't provide any explanation about what it did with the complaint after it was admittedly personally served. There's no explanation whatsoever. And that's why I believe the Howard case is important. The Howard case talks about the fact that the burden is on the party trying to avoid default to explain themselves. What did you do in the exercise of due diligence to protect yourself? It's not enough to say, we did something, we tried, we hired an attorney. They need to explain. What did you do with service of the summons and complaint once it reached you? What did you do with the notice of filing that the district court sent to you personally, just like this case? And in that case, it's very clear that when a party is given multiple opportunities to respond timely, when a party is given multiple opportunities to ensure that their counsel is doing things correctly, that they need to take that opportunity and they need to use it. It's not enough to sit on their laurels. I think what...
Howard, by the way, was we affirmed a district court's refusal to vacate default. So I'm not really seeing one. You know, there's a broad zone of discretion on default judgment. I know you're saying we should do it de novo, but that it's a very different thing to tell a district court you abused your discretion by denying it or you know.
And here's what I would say, even regardless of whether it's de novo, because there is questionable about whether these are correct findings because the court deviated.
Findings by, that's a tongue twister, isn't it?
It certainly is.
There are pending findings by the district court in from remand, though.
Right. The question is whether or not the court, whether those are proper, because the court did not follow the remand instructions, which is mandatory and required.
What part of the remand instructions did the district court not follow?
You know, and I fleshed this out in our brief, but there are a number of things that the district court did not do. Number one, expansion of the record. And implication that that information was in fact used.
But the district court made it clear that, first of all, both the parties agreed with the district court to provide supplemental briefing. The district court said, you know what, and with the risk of being reversed, I'm going to ask for information about what had been done, but I'm going to make clear whether or not I'm going to rely on it or not. And the district court made clear I'm not going to rely on that information in the decision. So... But even putting all that aside, we still review the pendant factors discussion for an abuse of discretion.
I agree with that, Your Honor. I agree with everything up to the point of, you know, I respectfully disagree. I think it's not as clear that the court did not use the information for the reasons that I've cited. She also indicated, I believe, in her at oral argument when we were talking about refresher briefing that she was going to specifically indicate whether or not she relied, and the order does not include that information, and I think the implication is that she did. The fact that it's questionable is a problem when the court doesn't follow the remand instruction. But I'm going to set that aside and move on to the abuse of discretion argument, because regardless of whether it's abuse of discretion or de novo, reverse and remand is still warranted. Misapprehension of the law or factual findings that do not resound in the record or conflict with the record both constitute abuse of discretion. The Cole case discusses the Northland Temporaries versus Turpin case, where the court is clear and states that the discretion by the district court is not unlimited. It still needs to resound in the record. And the cases repeatedly reference the fact that any factual findings need to reflect what's in the actual record. Halvorsen, Howard, Imperial Premium, even Cole. So that is clear. I think that the reply brief does a nice job of laying out the issues with the facts upon which the court relied. And that is part of what I would consider problematic. We now have this 2022 information that was presented to the court. It's very hard to unhear things that have now been heard. And the truth is, the facts upon which the court relied, because that record was permitted to be expanded, there was a response to that showing that many of the things upon which the court relied were actually factually inaccurate. And the court really lays out in depth the citations and the reasons why that is true in this particular case. So we have a number of facts that are incorrect. The court also used a conclusory statement when she was looking at reasonable excuse and basically said that, in quotes, that Hiscox entrusted its defense to its counsel, but did not address anything other that Hiscox as the party itself did, which is contrary to what this court ordered the judge to do, which was, you know, finding the court did not explain how the factors favored denial of the motion or what this argument may overlook, that the complaint was served on Hiscox's corporate counsel in Chicago. If Hiscox itself was aware of the complaint, then the responsibility for any ensuing delay might not lie solely with its counsel. There's no explanation in the order. It's a conclusory statement. That is not enough under the law.
So if we assume, because we're running low on your time,
yes.
If we assume for purposes of argument that we would not reverse a district court on default judgment, you have the next argument, which is, oh, but entry of summary judgment is a problem.
Yes.
So I am very much trying to figure out why. So at the first appeal, default judgment denied, summary judgment granted. You moved for it. Your client moved for it. No issues of material fact. This is a question of law. We're entitled to win, right? Okay, summary judgment is entered for the non-moving party, I believe. That goes up on appeal. I think on appeal you argue, no, we're entitled to it, not them. There's no material dispute of fact that needs to go to a jury question, et cetera. We remand and say to the district court, reconsider your default judgment, or reconsider that. It does. And then the rest of the case, it just enters the rest of it, because why would it not? Like, the case needs to come to a resolution, whether it was a trial or a summary judgment. It's not ending on the fact of a denial of default judgment. If it had been tried, I don't think, unless you argue to me, that the district court had to retry the case once it decided to reaffirm its default judgment motion. So why does it need to do anything more on summary judgment, especially when there's a complete identity of issues between a reasonable defense on the merits and the summary judgment motion? Like, it's not like one was personal jurisdiction. It's like they're identical issues. And on remand, you briefed contract language favors my client, whether it's plain or ambiguous. Estoppel, we win. Course of dealing, we win. Impossibility, we win. Pre-award interest, we win. Appraisal award, we win. I can't figure out what more you have to say on summary judgment. That's not been said.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I would respectfully respond two ways. Number one, I would look at the Colby 1 order, which specifically said, look, the district court did not address this concept of ambiguous language. And it, you know.
But it did on remand, though.
On remand, the court did, Your Honor, yes. But in Colby 1, this court is clear that ambiguous language of this nature is a fact question for the jury.
Right, but the district court said the language is not ambiguous. It's plain and unambiguous, and then applied the plain and unambiguous language.
Yes, I understand that, Your Honor. And again, that's part of this court's de novo review in terms of the reasonable defense on the merit. However, that's a different analysis than on summary judgment. I would also note—
You cannot argue on remand. You argued plain language, ambiguous language is in favor of coverage. This is a question of law.
Yes.
And that's what you argued before the appeal. So what you seem to be arguing now is based on discussion in the Court of Appeals order about ambiguity. They also, the next paragraph, talk about ambiguous language favors coverage, if you look at the next paragraph in
Correct.
Our previous order.
Yes.
But now you're arguing that I think that you should have had the opportunity for the first time to argue at summary judgment that there's a material disputed fact that needs to go to the jury. And I think that's what you're arguing, because the law was certainly briefed.
Right.
So what is a material disputed fact that for the first time Colby says needs to go to the jury?
Right. Well,
or to a fact finder.
Certainly. And I just would like to, because I know my time is running short, I think that part of the other issues here are not only, you know, I think that truly, like, ambiguous language needs to be construed in favor of coverage. And that's part of the reason why, you know, we've had further decisions come out. And I know it's not precedential, but Judge Ireland's decision in the Raspberry Ridge case on the same language came out completely opposite to Judge Moss's, which calls into question that this language should be construed in favor of coverage for the insured. It's not just Attorney Bergstrom saying that. Also, we can't disregard the fact that the court did allow expansion of the record, and that has raised a number of factual issues, including...
Factual issue that would go to a fact finder.
Sure. So, most of it would respond... I'm out of time.
You may answer the question.
Thank you very much. In terms of the factual issues that would go to the jury, all of this lends to things like estoppel and waiver. And these were all factually asserted issues on the first round of summary judgment that frankly should have been denied. We have more information now just about Hiscox, their construction of this language. There was also not presentation of other information such as the payments, the prior conduct by the insurance company in paying for replacement cost benefits. All of these lend to a fact question on summary judgment, including the new information that Hiscox volunteered in 2022 and other information that's come to light since then, including admissions from Hiscox representatives in depositions in very similar cases.
Thank you very much, Counsel. And you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent, please state your name for the record and party you are representing, and you have 15 minutes as well.
Thank you to the panel. May it please the court, opposing counsel Chris Goodman for the respondent, Hiscox Insurance Company, Inc. This is an action to recover replacement cost benefits under an insurance policy. Replacement cost benefits are owed when the repairs are completed. It's undisputed that when the action was filed, when the default motion was heard in January 2020, and when current counsel argued the renewed default motion in October of 2021, the siding work on the property had not been completed. Per the appraisal panel's award, siding at $417,000 was the largest category of repair awarded. Therefore, Judge Moss correctly applied the law to the undisputed facts in concluding that not only was there a reasonable defense on the merits, but there was a complete defense to liability for the claim once it proceeded. That segues into the first issue for the raised on appeal here, which is the decision to again deny a default motion brought by the appellant. We've got the Finden factors, and the first and foremost one is whether there's a reasonable defense on the merits. Something that kind of gets lost here is the burden for my client when getting to that first factor is not to prove the defense, although the district court certainly reached it later on in the case. It's simply to assert a defense that, if proven, would be a complete defense to the claim. That's the Northland Temples case. I believe in that case, or one of the other ones we cited, it was an assault case. There was a self-defense asserted as an affirmative defense. And that was good enough to say, hey, if it's proven, That's a complete defense. Ergo, the first fin, in fact, the most important factor is satisfied. I'm going to skip over to prejudice and due diligence, just simply to say those were not argued before the district court when the default motion was originally presented. We've got findings in the district court's order from following the October 2021 hearing saying that those dispute over those issues were waived. So that leaves us with reasonable excuse.
Before you move on, let's assume for the sake of argument that the due diligence in particular was not waived. I want to focus on that because Hiscox was informed. The record is clear. Hiscox had received information about the default judgment motion. So why shouldn't Hiscox be held responsible? This isn't a situation where we've had in other cases where we don't look at what happened with the counsel. I mean, Hiscox had, five attorneys who reviewed it, saw it, said that they were taking action within 7 minutes. And if they're supposed to be following up with outside counsel, what in the record prior to February 26, 2020 is there to support the district court's decision on that particular Findon factor?
The first thing I'll say, Your Honor, is I think we're talking the where I was at in my presentation was the due diligence and prejudice factor. I think Your Honor's question speaks to reasonable excuse, so I'm going to do one then the other. So for diligence, we cited in our brief, a motion to vacate filed 3 months after default is reasonable. That's Kemmer Irvy State Farm from 1994.
Right, I understand that. That's for outside counsel, though. But I want to focus on in-house counsel.
Right. So counsel had pointed to... I'm sorry, go ahead, Your Honor.
Yep, go ahead.
So addendum 14 is the page the counsel referred to in her presentation. And this is a paragraph in Judge Moss's order denying the renewed motion for default where the judge chronicles the information that was in the record before February 26, 2020, that supported the conclusion of the district court, both times the default motion was considered, that there was a reasonable excuse. And to just briefly rattle those off, we start with the Findon v. Class case. I wish I could say I had all this stuff memorized. But in that case, and I believe Judge Smith may have been channeling this decision, the decision to enter default was vacated because the defendant had retained counsel, and although the counsel's error was inexcusable, the default judgment was reversed because of the cardinal rule. We have a liberal policy of resolving claims on the merits, and the defendant entrusted the matter entirely to his attorney. That's what Hiscox did here. That's what Judge Masha's order said. They had local counsel. Coincidentally, the same day this action was served on my client in Chicago, September 12, 2019, my client's files were being transferred from attorney Tony Krall at Mirren Gear here in Minnesota to Jeanette Dixon at Manning & Cass in New York. There are two instances in the record, one being an affidavit last year from prior counsel Bradley Hammond, where he acknowledges that his firm, Smith Jaden, knew on September 11th, 2019, that Hiscox was changing counsel. According to the district court's findings, the plaintiff then appellant seizes on that opportunity by serving the complaint while all these files were in a state of flux. So first of all, we have, just like in Findon v. Class, counsel was retained. There was someone there to represent and protect the insurer's interests, the defendant's interests. And then the order goes through the things that occurred. And documents 28 and 33 are Jeanette Dixon's affidavits from January 20th and 30th of 2020. And if I could just synthesize those two very briefly, Ms. Dixon's firm looked at the 28 files and concluded that there was no complaint that needed to be responded to when they initially reviewed the Colby Lake file. That was incorrect. Later on, when they receive in the United States mail a copy of the default motion, which wasn't sent to me as local counsel and wasn't emailed to the New York attorneys, even though they had their contact information, they go back and look, and then they realize that there was a complaint in the file. Well, that's neglect. That's a mistake. That's not something an attorney should do. Obviously, if there wasn't some level of neglect, we wouldn't have the default motion in the first place. There would have been an answer served. But the issue under Findon v. Class is whether that is inexcusable. Even if it is inexcusable, did the client rely on, did they entrust to their attorney the responsibility to protect their interests? Hiscox did the same thing, based on the record that existed before the February 26th of 2020, to protect its interests. And the attorney, as the district court found, caught in the swirl of this transfer of 28 files, made a mistake. So the order at addendum 14 talks about the various data points, if you will, evidence, but that all can be found in these two affidavits from Jeanette Dixon. To dial into that a little deeper, Ms. Dixon also says that when the files were transferred, she was having conversations with Attorney Kroll here in Minnesota about the status of the cases in general. In the January 30th, 2020 affidavit, Ms. Dixon avers that she was informed there was a tolling agreement in place, that the appellant wanted to extend it, and that there was a custom and practice where the Smith-Jaden firm was granting indefinite extensions. And so that reinforced, that buttressed the conclusion that there was no response due at the time. Initially, they made a mistake in concluding that there wasn't a complaint served in their file. It was, and that's acknowledged in the second affidavit from Ms. Dixon. They made a mistake. They had 28 files, and there was a mistake made on that. But Finnan v. Klass tells us, the Supreme Court tells us in that case, that when the defense is entrusted to counsel and counsel makes a mistake, that's excusable neglect. Also, counsel mentioned the Cole v. Wirtzke case about three times. That's an odd citation, considering that case says that, the Supreme Court says, the appellate courts are to defer to the sound discretion of the trial court, which receives all this evidence, in exercising its discretion in deciding whether the excuse is reasonable. And so, again, to Judge Smith's question to the appellant from earlier, plaintiff's asking the court to take that discretion away from the district court. And frankly, there is no manifest error of law, clear error of law, or manifest injustice in terms of the facts, where no reasonable mind could look at these facts and agree with the district court. They had counsel. Counsel made a mistake. That there's no precedent that says that is sufficient to conclude that there wasn't a reasonable excuse and therefore default is appropriate.
What are we supposed to make of the fact that we made it very clear in our prior order that the district court is not supposed to look at anything beyond February 26th of 2020? And it appears from the record that the district court said, well, at the risk of being overturned by the Court of Appeals, I'm going to, you know, poke my nose under the tent here and look at what happened post that date.
Yeah, the focus at the January 2020 hearing, which I was at a lifetime ago, was why didn't counsel respond? That was the colloquy with the district court judge, which then prompted the request for an affidavit from the New York lawyer, Jeanette Dixon. That's the January 20th affidavit. There was an objection to that by the appellant. A request was made by the court for a second affidavit. We get the January 30th affidavit. That is the effort, that is the ask from the court for more information. There wasn't an argument, there wasn't an emphasis at the hearing that Hiscox had done something wrong. But the point I was making earlier, Your Honor, to this question, the last one, again, addendum page 14, that's where the court is at one instance in the order looking at those two affidavits and saying what information was available to me as of February 26, 2020. And the evidence available to the court was that there was counsel retained, there was a number of files transferred, and a mistake was made. This was not a case, as we have in some of the other decisions, where reasonable excuse has not been found, where, as an example, there's a Hovelson and a Harvelson, I believe, that appellant cites. I get the two confused. But in one of them, corporate counsel accepts service, corporate officer accepts service and sits on the pleading. That's culpability for the defendant. In another case, Safeco, I believe, there's a pre-suit settlement offer and an unsigned complaint. The defendant in that case drops the ball, Safeco, and this court concludes that contributed to the failure of counsel to timely respond to the pleading. So there are clear findings in those cases that the defendant did something to contribute to the failure to timely respond. And we just don't have that here. We have, if we do look at the information that was submitted after the remand, all it does is corroborate what Ms. Dixon said. She had the complaint. Her firm had the complaint. The disconnect is, and the neglect that causes the default motion and the answer to not be timely served, is they made a mistake in concluding that there wasn't a complaint in the file that needed to be responded to during their initial sweep of the file. And that's the neglect. But when, again, Finnan v. Klass, when counsel is retained and they just make a mistake, that is not enough to say that there's an abuse of discretion and come up with a different outcome. Judge Smith's made another point. Is there a case out there where this court has said that a default motion that was denied was an abuse of discretion, and this court will then insert its judgment based on its review of the record, that in this case the district court considered twice, and say, no, there was not a reasonable excuse. I'm not aware of a case that says that, and I haven't had to read one that the appellant has cited either. So
at least
that would
where
be
they had counsel. I think one of them was a reversal when they didn't have counsel, right?
When they,
I think that's a
the
dim
the three H cases, Your Honor.
24 hours ago. So,
yes.
Can I ask you a merits question?
Yes, Your Honor.
And this is inarticulate, and I apologize for it. But the and not I want you to speak to what the insurance company paid was, you know, $497,000 actual ACV, right? And then $188,000 in RCV. Okay, that's what they paid. Later. You sort of combine those together analytically into ACV, right? And say, oh, we paid actual cost value because we'll add those two together, even though they were differently characterized at the time of payment. What difference does it make? Why does it not make a difference?
My very short answer to that, Your Honor, is a dollar is a dollar. If plaintiff gets the appraisal award for $673,000, there was a $75,000 deductible. But just set that aside for a second. The way this is supposed to work, it's considered seed money. There's case law and Wint on insurance says this. You turn around and you ask a contractor to do the scope of repair that's described by the appraisal panel. $673,000 should get that done. A year before the appraisal award, those two payments from my client added up to over $686,000. So if you apply the deductible, the insured has $87,000 more than they were entitled to cover the actual cash value of the repairs. And they had the money a year before the appraisal award came out. So to take the plaintiff's argument, maybe in a hypothetical, if I hire someone to paint my house and there are progress payments and I make a mistake and I have a down payment and a progress payment of $2,000 and the whole project just happens to be $2,000, but it was meant to be in three payments. And the guy comes back, it's the person doing the work comes back and says, well, you owe me that third payment. Well, that's intellectually dishonest. I owe you $2,000. I just happen to pay you twice instead of three times. You still have the money. And that's academically, that's what the case is. Do they have the actual cash value of the award? Yes, they have more than the actual cash value after the deductible and without the deductible.
So apropos of the, so was 686 paid before the 200 days expired?
The first of those payments was February 2018. The 200 days, I think, was mid-January 2018. The district court, if I can continue with that, the district court addressed that on the first and second orders denying the default motion by saying the inspection that a company called Engel Martin did for my client in July 2017, the month that the claim was reported, eliminated the risk that commencing repair, because the policy doesn't require completion of repair, would have jeopardized coverage. So there was a specific finding on that by the district court that that wouldn't have been a problem for them to commence repair.
So looking at the way the contract operates is, and I don't have it right in front of me, I should, but it's, you know, after actual cash value is paid, party can request RCV provided that repairs have started within 200 days, right? And the problem, I think, is pointed out that what if that ACV is not paid within that time? That seed money isn't there. How can that contract read that within 200 days you have to start repairs when it's all, you know, that first part after we may ask for it? But what if you haven't ever, the insurance company has never paid the ACV?
Yeah, 2 points. One with the red blinking light here. Number one, as I said at the outset, the failure to complete repair is a condition precedent to getting replacement cost coverage. It's undisputed the repairs aren't completed. So it's undisputed that no money is owed. That's kind of glossed over by the appellant. But to your specific question, Your Honor, the way we argued that provision in our brief to the court, after the ACV has been paid, which begins that section of the policy, describes when the claim for replacement cost benefits is made. You can't ask us for replacement cost until after the ACV has been paid. Okay, but then we have the word if in there, the condition. The condition is if you've notified us that you commenced repair within 200 days. So
I get all of that. I'm just saying, what if the ACV isn't paid until 300 days? You know, they had to start repair without seed money. That's my point, that would be the interpretation of if the contract, that you're just kind of out of luck if the insurer, in whose hands it is, doesn't pay them within 200 days. It's like you better
right.
just, I guess, start repairing even though you haven't gotten anything?
The 200 days is in concert with the loss condition, another condition precedent to coverage, that the insurer is entitled to prompt notice of the loss. But to Your Honor's question, the Bondi case, on non-precedential, that interpreted a similar provision, had the problem Your Honor's talking about. It required completion of repair. And in that case, the Court of Appeals said the plaintiff was unable to tie the failure to get the payment to complete the repair, and therefore we're going to enforce it. Here, yes, they didn't have the money, but they didn't have to complete anything. There was no quantitative or qualitative level of work they had to achieve. I mean, if we're being literal, it's literally just commence repair. And the argument that was raised to the district court twice was, well, that would have jeopardized coverage. The district court addressed that. There was a full inspection by Engel Martin within 2 weeks of getting notice of the claim, well within the 200 days. And they made a loss adjustment out of that, which then led to the 2018 payment. So for those reasons, we'd ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I want to start by addressing the issue that was just raised, because I think it goes to one of the mistakes of law here in construing the policy. First and foremost, there are competing provisions within this insurance policy where my client was required to preserve that evidence. The court erred by concluding that after the first inspection, we could simply go ahead and begin repairs, because as the record is clear, that investigative process by Hiscox Insurance Company extended for yet another year and a half prior to appraisal. It's also notable that really this is hinging on the siding, because undisputably the roof was repaired as soon as that adjustment process was initially completed and enough funds were issued for them to begin that work. It is unfair for the insurance company to combine ACV and RCV payments when the policy separates those, and they know, and it's clear, that those combined payments that they issued, both ACV and RCV of the $600 and approximate $27, was all paid toward the roof. There was no money left to even begin the siding, and siding repairs could not commence because it was going to appraisal. Appraisal was demanded in August of 2018. Because of the additional investigation demanded, appraisal did not happen until July of 2019. There was a matching issue. A matching issue requires that the product remain on the structure so that the panel can do a comparison of whether or not the product being proposed for repairs is a reasonable match. Cedar Bluff, Elm Creek Courtroom, or Court Homes, those cases are clear on that issue. The court did not take any of that into consideration. That is relevant here because abuse of discretion also hinges on a misapprehension of the law. Construing an ambiguity against coverage, that's a misapprehension of the law. Shifting the burden of proof onto Colby to prove the Findon factors, including things like due diligence, including the court specifically called out that Colby didn't prove a lack of prejudice. That is not my client's burden. It was Hiscox's burden to prove that there wasn't prejudice. And I want to talk about prejudice just for a second here, because normally delay is not prejudice. Mere delay is not. Delay of trial can be prejudicial. And in this case, Hiscox leveraged the delay after appraisal, when the rest of the repairs could happen, to say, you didn't repair within a reasonable time, therefore we're denying coverage. That is very different than mere delay.
Well, the delay in the Findon factors is failure to answer on time, which was early October until the answer is December. What's the prejudice from those months?
Because I would say, Your Honor, it goes back to no one has argued that the repairs could not happen prior to appraisal, except for the court did conclude that, not taking into consideration the practicalities of the appraisal process, number one, or the fact that my client had been repeatedly reassured that replacement cost benefits were in fact available to them, including that payment in August of 2018 of the $188,000.
I ask you a math question before?
Yes. I'd be happy to answer any math questions for you.
And I'm sure it's in there, and my apologies for just not getting it.
Totally.
The total amount you ask on the for the remaining appraisal award,
yes,
is $106,226 plus $263,56. You say $106,226 is the outstanding ACV. I didn't know where that number came from. Or the 260, if you know. I just
certainly. And I'm looking at, I think this is my reply brief. This is my moving brief at page 49. I do a breakdown of the actual cast. Let me go to my, I know that it's also in my reply brief, where I do a breakdown of how much is owed.
I know what you say is owed. I just didn't know where that number 360.
Oh, certainly.
Where the 100 plus 260 came from. I couldn't get anything to add up to 100 remaining on the AC.
Sure, certainly. So we look at the appraisal award and we interface that with the policy language and the payments that were made, which is why, you know, following the appraisal award being issued, there's request by prior counsel for my client that they obtain the payment logs from Hiscox Insurance Company. So we have the ACV that's awarded of 673. We subtract the prior ACV payment of 497 and change, mm-hmm. and then take off the 336 for gutters and the $75,000 for the deductible.
Okay.
And then that's how we come up with that number. And then the replacement cost value column is similarly mathematically calculated, where we remove, you know, the 449 is that recoverable. So replacement cost value, really that second payment is called recoverable depreciation. So we've got the 449 that would be owed there, plus another 224 deduction for the gutters. And the 188 payment, which leaves the 263.54 for the amount remaining there. Upon that amount, interest is certainly owed, and I don't want to overstate that issue because that's separate from a summary judgment issue. I think that for that reason, summary judgment is also being improperly granted here. The court misconstrued point blank the law on statutory interest, and I think the case law is becoming increasingly clear on this issue.
And you briefed this remand.
I did. Yes, ma'am. I see that my time is up. Thank you so much for the court.
Thank you both, counsel, for your oral arguments and your briefing, extensive briefing. I appreciate it. A number of issues that we have to carefully look at. We'll be issuing an order. We will be issuing an opinion within the statutory time frame. Thank you both.
Thank you
all.
Just can't wait to get in the box. Let's go.